Oh, hey, how are you? Great to hear. Yeah, come in. Make yourself comfortable. Like a drink? Sure. There you go. Welcome to the Tech Lounge. Shall we begin?
Welcome to the Tech Lounge. As always, with me, Christian Giller. I am on the road again, but in a slightly echoey, but slightly maybe quieter environment than normal. And I'm going to introduce you to an episode, actually return guest to the show. I last spoke to Mark Collier when he was at the Open Infrastructure Foundation, OpenStack World. And now he is heading up the PyTorch Foundation at the Linux Foundation. And I was recently at PyTorch Con, I think, PyTorch EU in Paris, where I spoke to a few people, including Mark, and more of those interviews will be coming out over the coming months. But he's been at the job for a very short period of time, and because of the whole AI craze, even somewhat more mature tools in the AI process, in this case for training models, are a very active and interesting space. So it was good to have a chat with Mark. Enjoy. Git is an essential tool and workflow for almost any developer in the world these days. And Git can be easy for some, but hard for others. And I've always been a fan of Git graphical tools, Git GUIs that help me and could help you understand some of those more esoteric commands or just speed up what you do on a regular basis. Tower is perhaps one of the oldest and preeminent and best known Mac and Windows Git GUIs. And if you want to get 25% off their full price tool, then head on over to go.christianchiller.com/Tower.
We have spoken before, so maybe let's do a little bit of a backfilling of your background up until the PyTorch Foundation.
Just sure.
Very briefly.
Yeah, so you know, I've been involved in open source for almost 20 years, mostly focused on a project I started back in 2010 called OpenStack, mm-hmm. which has become one of the most popular open source projects for cloud computing and used all over the world, and sort of put that into a nonprofit foundation, and then focused on that for a number of years. And then about a year ago, actually, we merged it into the Linux Foundation, which really has a number of foundations like CNCF and PyTorch Foundation that are part of the larger Linux Foundation network. And that really kind of made sure that our projects that were part of what was actually the Open Infra Foundation, once we expanded it from OpenStack to Open Infra, gave them a long-term stable home, and then gave myself and my co-founder, Jonathan Bryce, an opportunity to work in some other areas, contribute to open source beyond what we were doing before. And so he's actually now the executive director of CNCF. And mm-hmm. now I'm recently was appointed as the executive director for PyTorch Foundation. So that's kind of the quick summary.
And I think 2 years ago at KubeCon in Paris, I interviewed Thierry, is it?
Yes.
He's now the current president, so if people want to find out more.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So Thierry joined with our whole team, came over when we joined the Linux Foundation. He's been running the Open Infra Foundation for a number of years now.
Let's talk about
doing
the
a
present.
Great job.
Let's talk about the present. Let's not go back to the past. We can
revisit
the past in other shows. Self plug. For people who are, a lot of this talk and this event will be talking about a subject that has become very commonplace now, mm-hmm. But AI is not new, mm-hmm. and a lot of the tools to build the underpinnings of it are also not new, mm-hmm. including PyTorch. Mm-hmm. So for people who are new to PyTorch, though, what is it and what kind of part of the tool chain in the AI landscape mm-hmm. is it?
Yeah, so I think you're right. AI has sort of become incredibly mainstream now, and everyone's using it and reading about it. But a lot of the roots go back many, many years, decades even. PyTorch is 6 or 7 years old. But I think that the simplest way to think about it is that when you use one of these AI services and it's got a model that's behind it, that model was almost certainly trained using PyTorch, which is really kind of a deep learning framework that AI researchers use when they're going through this training phase. So you can sort of think of AI as broadly having this phase of training, something that we call inference, which is basically when the model's being served after you've already kind of baked the model, and then agents, which are really kind of more of a way long running loop or a way to kind of call tools and essentially just get more utility out of the models. But it all kind of comes back to how did you create the model in the first place before you can serve it and put it in front of, you know, behind a web UI like ChatGPT or something like that. Mm-hmm. So all those fundamental breakthroughs, all those models that keep getting better and better and better, they are those training runs where basically, this huge data center full of GPUs, NVIDIA hardware, AMD, whatever it may be, is being used to kind of train the models where you put tons of data in and you put tons of compute in. So the coordination of all that is really managed by the PyTorch project, which is, you know, an open source project.
And I think there's some slightly, again, we say older, which in technology doesn't always mean very much, around terminology around tensors and things, which I'm guessing... This is kind of a space that I understand without ever having dug too deep into it because it's quite complex.
Right.
There's TensorFlow. Are these sort of comparable frameworks? They're competing in quote marks frameworks or?
Yeah, TensorFlow is an equivalent, alternate choice. Yeah, for doing the same type of work, which is, you know, basically managing these model training training runs, for lack of a better word.
I heard a quote from somebody, I'm not sure if it was from you, and it was very quick. So 9 out of 10 papers use PyTorch, I heard in the keynotes. And you or someone else also said 90% of open source, actually this is a better quote, 90% of open source ML projects use PyTorch.
Yes, yes.
I mean, firstly, do you know which ones? I guess you do, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of different aspects to this. One is the research papers are all, you know, published publicly. And so if you go look through the thousands and thousands of AI research papers that are published every year, you can see in the citations, you know, how the research was done and what tools they used. And it says plainly in there, PyTorch, you know, over and over again. And so that's kind of like one of the stats that you get. And in terms of more of the usage, you know, in the real world, you know, how do we know who's using PyTorch? And to some extent with open source, you never know exactly every single person using it. But a lot of the people that are using PyTorch in the major AI labs are you know, it's not a secret. They come to this conference. They, you know, they're involved in the community. They have questions they want to answer. They want to contribute to the code. So we do, you know, really a lot of the people that are using it in terms of like using it to train their models. And like I said, people are actually, they're usually pretty proud of it. You know, they are grateful, frankly, that if they want to create a model that a tool like this exists, that's very mature, that's evolving all the time to support the latest hardware, you know, innovations that are coming out. And they're just excited that it's open and that they have it available and they don't have to reinvent the wheel internally. So most people are pretty enthusiastic about saying, oh yeah, we're using PyTorch and we're just grateful it exists.
And do you have even a vague kind of ballpark idea of non-open models that use it?
Yeah, I mean, yes. and I think, you know, I don't know which ones I can, you know, cite, it's actually very much the standard for training models that are for proprietary labs as well. Yeah. So yeah, at the end of the day, when you're done training your model, the company who's done it, they may choose to publish the weights and make it an open weight model, or they may not, but they're still fundamentally at least using, you know, this set of open source tools to create the model in the first place. You know, there's nothing that forces you to make the model open just because you used PyTorch. That's always a choice people make, but the fact that actually it's widely adopted, even with sort of what you would call like the closed labs, is actually a good thing. I mean, I think you always want more adoption when you're building open source software, because it just means more feedback, more contribution, you know, more people saying, hey, it breaks at this scale. Oh, let's re-architect it. So, you know, the bigger the user, the more complex their use case, the better their feedback is to make the project better for everyone, including people who then want to release their models in the open. So it really kind of benefits everyone.
Let's dig into that a little bit. This is a potentially controversial question, so we'll see if you want to answer it or not. I'm not sure. But there's a foundation, especially at the kind of Linux Foundation level, is sort of striking this balance between survival and sustainability of the projects it stewards, mm-hmm. and also kind of keeping that open source mentality and virtue alive. But there have been some, the model space is complicated when it comes to open. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about it for a few years, and I kind of lost track of whether we've happy with the definition yet. But also, it's a space that is where the open source and kind of AI companies are getting so complexly related to each other. Mm-hmm. And AI is, some people are saying it's ruining open source, and some people are saying it's amazing for open source. And in your keynote, you kind of took the more positive approach. But is it challenging at the moment to really kind of get this almost out of control ecosystem and open source to play nicely with each other? Or is open source in some places suffering a little bit because of that just massive, massive rollout of AI everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely the case of, you know, kind of an all of the above situation. Yeah. You know, it's like most things, it's not all good or all bad. And I do think that fundamentally, the nature of open source software development and open source communities is going to look a lot different a year from now than it does today. Mm. And how exactly will it look? No one knows. If anyone says they do, that they're definitely, don't have that crystal ball. But I think that it is kind of going to require a lot of new thinking and new processes and new norms around how we think about open source, because there, to sort of use the negative example that definitely is happening out there, is you do see kind of people that are flooding open source projects with pull requests for code that they didn't write because they just, you know, had Claude Code write it. And maybe it's good, maybe it's not, but if the effort that it takes to generate code just gets lower and lower, you could say, you know, cheaper and cheaper to generate lines of code, you know, that kind of, we need to come up with a new equilibrium, because the people who are reviewing that code and deciding whether to merge it or not, they, you know, they are getting overwhelmed in some cases by the sheer volume of it. Mm. And a big part of the sort of social contract in a way of open source is that when you propose a patch, you do a pull request, the people reviewing the code in the community are going to want to ask you questions and say, okay, why did you make this design decision? Or what's the goal of this? Or tell me about this line of code. And if the person who submitted it didn't actually write it themselves, they can't necessarily answer that. And I'm not saying like there are like there's a good people and bad people or whatever. It's just the nature of this changing landscape. So I think we're going to have to grapple with that. That's kind of the negative side. The positive side, and I've heard folks, including Greg KH, who's, you know, one of the leading Linux kernel developers, say that he, I think, was fairly skeptical on these AI tools 6 months ago, but really something has turned the corner. And from the standpoint of helping to identify bugs and security vulnerabilities, they're actually doing really quality work. And so some of these tools can help us make the open source software that we're relying on more secure, you know, identify bugs more quickly. So I think some of even people that were more skeptical 6 months ago, it's not that they were wrong back then. It's just the tools are making these huge leaps every, you know, few weeks and months.
Yeah.
So it's a changing thing. And I think that, like I said, open source is going to look differently a year from now. I think exactly how is something we have to all talk about.
That long away. I mean, yeah, it's all of the above of what you just said is correct and incorrect at the same time, I think, which is which is where we find ourselves right now. On the subject of contributions, we are at PyTorch Europe. Mm-hmm. And I can't actually, it was the speaker after you, the resonance? Anyway, doesn't matter. He showed this slide about the activity in Chinese, US, and other mm-hmm. rest of the world models. And the Chinese ones were actually way bigger than US ones. The foundation is announcing today some contributions from some of these sort of semi-commercial partners like Meta and Hugging Face. I don't know where to include Hugging Face on that because they're a strange kind of entity. And Meta is global. Hugging Face is kind of French. So when you have, I think there is a PyTorch event in China as well, I think, isn't there?
There is. In September, we're doing an event in Shanghai.
Do you have similar announcements there from some of the Chinese companies also contributing things into the ecosystem or plan to?
What I can say...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
What I can say is that anytime anybody puts on a big conference, open source or otherwise, there are always announcements. Yep. I literally... don't even know what they will be, but I do know there will be some because there's a nature at play here, a natural desire when people have been kind of working on things in the lab and then they see a conference coming like, ooh, let's get it ready and, let's announce it. So I'm sure that there will be, but honestly, don't even know what they are. I'm not keeping a secret. I don't know what it is.
I realized as I was asking that you probably have no idea right now, but it's open to it, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm sure there will be.
Yeah. And historically, actually, a lot of the big Chinese companies have been fairly good at it. We just don't, they're not as familiar. So we don't always think, it's familiar to us here, but they do. So the two announcements today, I actually wanted to maybe start with the one from Hugging Face, the safe tensors. It's interesting. If you go to their page, it says, it was very short and brief, ML safer for all.
Yes.
Which I found a singularly helpful and unhelpful statement. Safe in what way? What is safe tensors?
Yeah. So basically, when you take one of these models and you download it from the internet, probably Hugging Face being the most common place that people download models from. And then you want to take that model and sort of like run it in production and execute it and sort of, basically serve the model as an LLM, for example. Historically, the old sort of file format that was used to distribute these types of models wasn't as secure, and so it left open the possibility there could be untrusted code in the file, sort of sneakily hidden in there. And then when you went to run this model, lo and behold, there was a vulnerability. Yeah. So safe tensors is sort of like a packaging format or a file format that helps ensure that what you say you're downloading to go run is actually what was intended by the original author.
I suppose safety from within. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because I think last time I was at KubeCon in Paris, the big topic was like software supply chain from like images, Docker images.
Right.
Now we're at the model stage.
No, I think it's a pretty good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes sense. It's actually, the problem, one of the big problems with models is they're such a black box that people are, you don't really know what's in there and you may never even encounter it, but you might.
And the fact that in generally speaking they're non-deterministic is kind of hard for those of us with software brains we're used to thinking that would be considered a bug historically in software, but now it's a feature. As the old saying goes, it's not a bug, it's a feature. But
it's a desired feature, but it's certainly a feature we're coping with, that's for sure. And is that intending to be a kind of a standard that you would generally like everybody to adopt?
Mm-hmm.
Does it require much kind of process change to adopt it?
No, I think it's already quite widely adopted. And I think this is a case where, it's a natural fit for something like this to become part of, a neutral foundation, because it just encourages more adoption. It gives people a clear signal like this is going to be around for the long term. And I think it's already widely adopted, but anything we can do to just raise more awareness of it, encourage more people to adopt it, that's all good.
Okay. And then the second announcement we had was from Meta's, I guess, a division of Meta. Meta's open something.
yes.
Contributing Helion. Mm-hmm. This is something that when I was looking for links for these various things, you see that a lot of the project names that were spoken about in the keynotes are kind of like sub-projects or aspects of PyTorch. How would you describe things like that? Like, not quite a few, but like, no. Anyway, yeah. How would you describe those bits and pieces of PyTorch?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes it does get confusing because of, you know, trying to put things into a hierarchy, into categories or whatever. But in general, I think what you just see is that this community overall is trying to solve hard problems relating to, you know, training inference and agents around AI. And as a lot of these teams are just every day training models and running into, you know, the difficulty of doing it and wanting to make it more accessible, they start to create new tools or new layers of abstraction that can make it easier for them to do internally, let's say at Meta, but also they want to share with the world. And so Helion is an example of that. And so, you know, authoring kernels or writing basically Triton, using Triton is kind of difficult because it's just a highly complex area. And so Helion sort of provides a layer of abstraction above Triton so that you people that want to create these different kernels to execute on the GPUs and do all this, you know, fancy matrix parallel math can, you know, maybe we lower the barrier to the folks that you know, researchers and people wanting to program these systems and train these models. So that's kind of the origin of it. And in terms of like where it sits in the, you know, I guess, hierarchy, for lack of a better word, this, as of today, has become, you know, one of what we would consider a hosted project within the foundation. Mm-hmm. So similar to PyTorch, similar to Ray, similar to VLM or DeepSpeed. So, you know, to some extent, you know, I guess it's a bit of semantics, you know, where you categorize things, but we like to basically, I think, send a signal to the market like this is an important project. We want more people to contribute to it, more people to give feedback on it, more people to test it. And it just helps kind of complete the picture. I mean, the picture's never going to be complete because we're constantly evolving and we will be adding more projects that we want to support. But, you know, in particular, I think Helion is significant because it does lower the barrier to kind of one of the thornier, more complex things that has to happen in the day-to-day life of kind of like AI and just practitioners.
I think just to explain it a little bit more, because it actually makes a whole lot of sense when you know, if you come from a traditional programming world, mm-hmm. a DSL for authoring machine learning kernels, a DSL's domain-specific languages are fairly commonplace in the traditional programming world of simplifying mm-hmm. something that is complex. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, again, that we're at that stage where, like with the software security supply chain, mm-hmm. with the models that we used to have with the images, now we're having DSLs for kernel development because we've got to that stage where more people want to do it. And it's kind of too hard right now.
Right. So, yeah.
So it's sort of maturing but not maturing at the same time. You know, maturing and becoming... The barriers are getting lower, I suppose, as well at the same time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But just on that kind of, because PyTorch, much like if we look at with the CNCF, with Kubernetes, you know, it sort of starts out as one thing mm-hmm. and then gradually the foundation starts to add things around it. When do you make that decision that something should be part of the foundation as opposed to maybe just part of PyTorch itself or just its own thing, you know? What's usually the thought process with actually deciding what should be added and kind of given the official stamp?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for the PyTorch Foundation, you know, it's only been about a year since the PyTorch Foundation expanded to become a multi-project foundation.
Okay, so
maybe a little more than a year. Whereas like something like CNCF's been doing it for 10 plus years. So some of those questions are the ones we're as a community wrestling with right now. And I think it's actually a really important question that you know, we need to be thinking about as we look ahead to the next few years, because I think it's important to have kind of a certain amount of focus and not just say, oh, we want to add projects because, you know, it's a bigger number. Like, we need to be thinking about what are the experts in the particular domains that, you know, our community has the best in the world, and how to, what are the problems we need to solve kind of within that without necessarily like just sprawling and adding projects that are just, you know, in no way related to, like, I would say, you know, training, inference, and agents, which is still a pretty big scope, but I mean, particularly when you think about kind of what PyTorch has historically been really strong in, and things that are adjacent to that, that's somewhat of the North Star for things we would want to add. But I think that, you know, every community has to always be kind of asking themselves, yeah, where do we want to specialize and make sure that we don't get you know, off track.
Yep, it's early days, and at this point. And two major new projects added after a year. I think you also mentioned 9 new members of the foundation this year. That's a good start, I suppose.
Yeah, it is.
The timing was right to do something like this. I sort of appreciate there's conversations and there's plans and there's unknowns, but let's say we were sitting here again in a year's time. What are some kind of loose trends of things that you would like to maybe accomplish and drive forward?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things that this is just kind of a hunch that I have, and, you know, we'll see if this turns out to be true, but I feel like we're actually going to see over the next year the blurring of the lines between what we consider training and what we consider inference. And you already kind of see this with reinforcement learning. And one of the things I talked about this morning is that Cursor is taking these kind of like open weight models from Kimmy, and then they're like using RL to improve the functionality for coding agent purposes, and they're now able to release a new version every 5 hours instead of like every 5 months. So this kind of feedback loop, or this, you know, continuous learning idea, is sort of the holy grail of, you know, AI, is that an AI that can improve itself. And you already see some AI, or, you know, dystopian, depending on which sci-fi books you read. But, you know, you can pick your sci-fi author as to whether this is dystopian or not. But, you know, we already see some recent AI models that were actually influenced by the previous model. Yeah. So there's some of this happening, you know, almost more of them in a manual way. But I think that, you know, that's just thinking at, like you said, a year ahead. You know, what will we see? I think we'll see more of these feedback loops. And I talked about this a little bit this morning, of this sort of like co-development that's going on between hardware and software, but also between sort of training and inference. So kind of creating the model and serving the model. How do we just tighten those feedback loops and so that the models can just get better and better at the things that, you know, we think are valuable as the users?
And in the brief few seconds we have left, I'm going to ask a slightly stupid question, but it's just been bugging me, so humor me, is, you know, much like Kubernetes and Docker had this kind of very loose, like, nautical Greek theme going on, I feel like there's a theme I'm spotting with naming of projects in the foundation, like PyTorch, Helion, Triton, but then I'm not sure. Is there a theme in there somewhere, or am I just imagining it?
That's a good question.
If you have to think about it, I guess it's a no.
Well, you know, it's quite possible that there is that I actually don't know, because I am relatively new to PyTorch. I've been, like I said, in open source a long time, but I'm really trying to get into this community and learn the lore and learn the, you know, so that's there's quite possibly an answer to that. I just don't know.
Yeah, and I was looking at the various things announced in the keynotes, like, there's sort of a vibe here, but I don't know if there's a theme.
No, I'm going to find out.
Well, that can be a question for next time.
Perfect.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck with you too.
So that was it. That was our guest today. Thank you very much for joining me in the Tech Lounge. I have been Christian Schiller. If you want to know more about Tech Lounge, head on over to christianschiller.com. techlounge.com, or please tell your friends about us. It's quiet and cozy in here, but the more listeners, the merrier. You can find more at christianschiller.com/podcast or in the show notes or episode notes, wherever you found this podcast. Thank you very much for joining me, and you're most welcome next time.